We get things underway this hour by welcoming back to the program a woman who writes about pop culture and television, is the author of a number of terrific books that we've talked about here before, including Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted, Seinfeldia, Sex and the City and Us, and her brand new one coming out officially on March 23rd, but you can pre-order now, called When Women Invented Television, the untold story of the female powerhouses who pioneered the way we watch today. Jennifer Cation Armstrong with us. Jennifer, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you have written so much and so well about television and some pretty important women in the industry, but how fun was it for you to go back and research and learn even more about these women who were there really at the genesis of the industry?
It was so much fun because, you know, I was not alive yet in 1948. To 1955. And it was a crazy time in television. I mean, just that alone, you know, leaving these women aside, just seeing the way television worked then, I mean, anything was possible. It was just like people were trying anything. Everything was live. It's just such a wacky time to be looking back on.
And it was a time of transition too. And so many of the people who would be the first stars of television had transitioned over from radio, and some of the women you wrote about also had that experience that radio was the bridge to television.
Yes, exactly. I mean, and it makes sense, right, that's how, you know, anytime it's like we'll take, you know, I don't know, a YouTube star and bring them to television. It's like it worked for you on radio, so let's give it a go on television. You already have a following from radio. People were at least a little familiar. So someone like Gertrude Berg, who is one of my main characters, you know, had a 17-year run on radio with her, what was essentially a family sitcom, The Goldbergs. And she really wanted to keep that going. And so she brilliantly sort of saw the potential in television and brought the same show, you know, she had raised her children, her sitcom children on radio from, you know, small children to adulthood. And she was like, look, I have a chance to do it all over again on television. And that was sort of her plan. And she saw the potential right away.
Well, Gertrude Berg is such a fascinating character. And I'm glad that more people through your book are going to learn about her, because she's got such a remarkable story, was in a position of great power within the industry, and really created the template for the modern sitcom.
Exactly. I mean, and also, you know, women we think of now, like a Tina Fey, right, who writes and produces and acts. It's like that's what Gertrude was doing. She created her show. She wrote most of the scripts herself. Starred in the show. She was fully in charge and even produced, you know, to the point where she really, it was like her checks that she was writing when she would pay, you know, the stars of her show. And really, like you said, set kind of that template. If you watch The Goldbergs on television from the beginning, a lot of those hallmarks that we recognize are there. It's a family. They're mostly takes place in the living room with a little in the kitchen, right? And they have these small problems sometimes with the neighbors, but they get resolved in an hour or in a half hour. And it just really, it's very familiar right away.
It's interesting. We have a cable channel that we get here that carries the Goldbergs. So I've had a chance to see a number of episodes. And it's, yeah, when you watch it, you say, well, I know that's 1949, but I know exactly what this is. But this mm-hmm. is the show that really started it in so many ways. And even some of the stock characters that we all have come to know.
Yeah, that's really true. One of my favorites from that show is Uncle David, who I really would call her sidekick, essentially, right? Because
right.
She has a husband on the show, but Uncle David can be home with her all day. She is a housewife, and, you know, he often wears an apron and is helping her in the kitchen and is kind of, you know, a little bit sort of put upon. And he talks a lot about how he's and also, because it's always like all of the family and also Uncle David, right? So he's kind of, he recognizes that he is a sidekick and really a foil for her powerful character.
Was it her success in radio that enabled her as a woman, as a Jewish woman, to get this level of power in the early television industry?
No doubt about that. There's no way this happens under any other circumstances. In fact, she still didn't have as much power as one might have thought. She took it to all of the networks at the time and was turned down on one whole round, you know, and then basically kind of marched into the office of William Paley, who was in charge of CBS, both radio and television, and said something to the effect of, look, I got you through the Depression on the radio, you know, and I think you should give me a television show, and kind of all but demanded that. And he eventually, that was when he gave in and said, okay, you know what, you're right, why not, let's give it a chance. And, you know, she's a 50-year-old Jewish woman at this point, so it is not what we think of as the 50s, you know, later, which really comes later, the 50s sitcom mom, right? More of like a Donna Reed, glamorous,
right,
young woman. This is, you know, she really, you wouldn't even, this, even now, this would be kind of extraordinary to see.
We're talking with Jennifer Cation Armstrong about her new book, When Women Invented Television. One of the through lines in the stories of the women that you write about are the challenges that they faced because of their gender, sometimes because of their religion, and sometimes because of their political beliefs. And Gertrude Berg, like so many, got pulled into what was going on with the Red Scare of the late 40s and early 50s. And the man who played her husband on the show, Philip Loeb, in many ways bore the brunt of the accusations that were made to try and spare her from some of that collateral damage.
Yeah, it's a really sad story because she was really, the show was just incredibly popular. Philip himself was popular. You know, he was like voted something like America's favorite father by the Boy Scouts of America. You know, they were the first show that was so successful on TV that went back to radio. And it was also the first show to be made into a movie. You know, they were really kind of like going. And then he was named in this 1950 list that kind of came out. And at first it was okay, but then people started, other shows started kind of firing people, and that gave others the idea that maybe this should happen. And so her sponsor, General Foods, asked her to fire him, and she refused at first. And this was really her show's downfall, because this kept them, they were supposed to come back easily in the fall on CBS, and instead they were kicked off the air on CBS. Probably, you know, CBS didn't say it was because of this, but, you know, suddenly they couldn't find a time slot kind of thing. And she kept negotiating behind the scenes to try to get the show back on the air, and it just wasn't happening. So it was off the air for a while. It eventually came back on NBC a season or two later. But you can see how that, you know, you can't just do that, especially at that time when people had to really be in front of their televisions at a specific time, watching a specific channel to see their show. It's like, so, you know, it just lost complete momentum there, and they brought it back. She eventually had to fire Philip Loeb. It was the only way it was going to work. And she did it, she said, because she felt like, you know, she's got all of these, the rest of the cast and crew to worry about as well. And she kept paying Philip Loeb. She had a deal with him to kind of keep him afloat. But it just, that's, I believe that this is why we do not know Gertrude's name the same way we know Lucille Ball's name.
Yeah, and she made guest appearances on other shows after the Goldbergs went off the air, but she never captured that level of fame and notoriety that she had in the late 40s.
Exactly, exactly. She was a regular on Burl, on Milton Berle, and people loved her. Like, every time she was on, the crowd went wild, and I've watched some of those old episodes. They're very fun. And, you know, it just, they couldn't quite overcome the loss of the momentum, like I said, that they had really early on. She had the right idea getting in early, you know, like, she could have been really, like, staked her claim, been there. In fact, one of my favorite heartbreaking facts is the fact that it was actually supposed to be that the Goldbergs and I Love Lucy was going to be paired together on CBS on Monday night. So it was kind of going to be the first must-see TV lineup, you know, and in a way this was meant to be so that the Goldbergs could give Lucy a boost. And instead, the Goldbergs got yanked off the air. Lucy ran on Mondays anyway and became an instant, you know, iconic success. So it really shows you that could have boosted Gertrude's career as well and kept it going.
Another one of the remarkable pioneers you write about is Erna Phillips, known as the Queen of the Soaps. And again, someone who pretty much invented a genre with shows like The Guiding Light, As the World Turns, the first real television serial, These Are My Children, Another World, and on and on.
Yeah, she was really remarkable. She was a real kind of like, you know, I think of her as like the Shonda Rhimes of her day. You know, it's like she had this empire. And she created daytime soaps originally for radio. She was asked by her boss to create something that women would like. And that's what she did. And she really built on that and brought, eventually, as you said, her big breakthrough success on television was Guiding Light, bringing it directly, interestingly, I think, from radio to television seamlessly. Like, they just kept the same exact stories going and brought it right along to television and had those actors on and simulcast a radio version and a TV version for a while. And, you know, that ran until recently. It's like this incredible success. And she mentored so many others. Plus, she really did invent this genre, everything from the organ cues that we still kind of think of as the hallmark of soaps, even if they still don't do it. Those dramatic pauses where they all look at each other after saying something big. And even the cliffhanger was something, I mean, surely we knew about suspense before her, but, you know, she really helped to pioneer this idea of like the way you keep people coming back every day is to end on a note where they have to know what happens next.
And for people who grew up in the 80s or 90s, when the daytime serials were in their decline, I don't think they know and appreciate how important those shows were to the success of television in the early days when you didn't have syndication. So local stations really had very little to air during the daytime hours unless they had someone in-house who could produce some sort of local show. So they relied on those soaps to fill up the program day.
Yeah, daytime is funny. It's one of the sort of side notes of this entire book, it's because I was writing about women and it was really considered women's realm, right? The daytime hours, because it was mostly housewives. And so I was so interested to find out about how everyone was kind of like, we don't know what to do during the day. it was just this like big stretch of time that they were constantly flummoxed by. You know, they were just always trying to figure out like, and, you know, of course, a lot of male execs are all going like, what do women want? We don't understand. And Erna was often the answer to that, even though they didn't always listen to her. She was usually right.
Now, a woman that I did not know much about, a fascinating story of the first Black American to host her own television show. Tell us a little bit about Hazel Scott.
Yeah, this is another one where you just cannot believe that we don't all know her name, right? My modern equivalent that I always give to her is I think of her as kind of the Beyonce of her time. And I don't think that's an overstatement. She was this beautiful, charismatic woman who was a jazz musician and very successful from a pretty early age. She really was like a teen star even, and was touring the country, was on the radio. She had a couple of things she did that people really loved. She could play two pianos at once on stage, which is pretty extraordinary. If you've ever tried to play one piano, you know that. And the other thing she did that was huge that everyone loved was she swung the classics. So like she would start out playing like a Bach song and slowly over the course of it would turn it more into like a boogie woogie, as they said. Really, you know, this was the cool thing at the time. And, you know, crowds went wild. She was touring all over the United States and even all over the world and drawing big crowds and playing at Cafe Society regularly in New York City, which was like a lefty hangout. It was the first integrated nightclub. So, and she also was married to Adam Clayton Powell Jr., who was a Black congressman from Harlem, one of the first Black congressmen, a very charismatic figure in himself, very handsome, great speaker, was a preacher. And the two of them together was really just this incredible power couple. They were always in Ebony magazine, often on the cover. You know, they wanted to know everything. Everybody wanted to know everything about their lives together. And so she was offered the chance to, in 1950, have a variety show on a network called Dumont, which obviously no longer exists. It ended in the late 50s, but it was a fourth network. And, you know, rightfully so, it just made so much sense that she would have a television show. If you see, unfortunately, recordings of the actual show are not out there, but you can see her on YouTube just playing with a camera, you know, to the camera, and you can just see how the camera loves her. All she has to do is say something like, "Hello, I'm Hazel Scott," and it's riveting. And she's really expressive and fun to watch. And so she would play the piano on her show with her band. And it started as local in New York City one night a week, and then went several nights a week, and then went national. And so she was the first Black person to host her own show in primetime nationally, and was doing great, like great reviews. All the reviews and like Variety and everything were saying, like, we need more of her. And she too ran into that same blacklist that Philip Loeb was on. She was on it as well, and things went south very quickly for her after that.
And finally, of someone we all know, but I'm not sure how many people know the full story of the remarkable career of Betty White, one of the real pioneers of television. She was nominated for the first Emmy Award and actually ended up losing that to Gertrude Berg. But she was the first woman to have full creative control of her series when she did Life with Elizabeth.
Yeah, and she was also on a daytime talk show, one of the first in Los Angeles, where she really became a star. And we were talking about that filling of time that they had to do on daytime. The answer in L.A. seemed to be put Betty White on 5.5 hours a day, 6 days a week, which still seems like a fair idea to me now. I mean, I think we'd all watch that. But, you know, yeah, she really was like there from the beginning. I think it explains a lot about what we see, what we have seen of her extraordinary career since. Like, to me, this really explained why she's so good. Like, she had this practice of both an early sitcom that she created and starred in herself and being, you know, improvising on television 5.5 hours a day, 6 days a week for several years. Like, you're going to get pretty quick on your feet if you do that. And so she really, like, she did a lot in those early days. And I was really struck by what a smart businesswoman she was, how savvy she was. She was great at working the press. I read a lot of interviews with her from the time. She knew exactly the kind of image she wanted to portray and really handled it. And, you know, she was still in her 20s at that time. It's pretty incredible.
When you went back and researched these women, was there a common thread connecting all of them, a trait that they all shared?
I think it was their determination, because obviously in some ways it's a bummer. These stories are a little, you know, there's not a perfect ending to a lot of this, because the whole point is that I'm telling you stories you don't know. But I think, God, just the way they kept going is truly incredible. And against these forces, I felt like they were almost like you could see them amassing on the horizon. It's like as television got more profitable, the men start to move in. You know, that's a large reason why women got to do so much in the early days, is no one knew what to do with television and it wasn't profitable yet. But as you reach like a 1955, these forces start to really amass, and it's like the men are coming in, they're going to take charge, they know what's best. And also, and they think that women should be a certain way. So there's a lot more pressure on these women to kind of like be that perfect 50s woman that we think of now. And they don't, none of these women are that, you know, they're very modern in that way. And so between like the blacklist and just patriarchy, these women sort of start to get pushed to the margins, but they are just, their determination was always incredible.
And they weren't just opening doors for women. They were really blazing a trail for the entire industry.
Yeah. And I mean, they say, they have said it in some form over and over themselves that like, I don't, that they, and I believe them, that they didn't have time to think about like, I am blazing a trail for women right now. They were really just trying to make their way, and they had this determination to do so, and felt like, I mean, I will say the feminist thing about them is they felt like they deserved it as much as anybody, you know? And yeah, that's the thing is they, I really wanted to pick women in this case. Women did a lot of things in television then, but I wanted to pick four women who specifically had some kind of creative impact on what we see on television now. And, you know, so that means not just that Gertrude was a female pioneer, but she invented the sitcom, you know, like that's something we all still can recognize today. And it's, it's crazy to, you almost forget that it had to be invented, but it did.
The book is called When Women Invented Television, The Untold Story of the Female Powerhouses Who Pioneered the Way We Watch Today. The newest book from Jennifer Cation Armstrong. You can pre-order it now, officially available on the 23rd. Jennifer, always great to talk with you. Thank you so much for making time for us today, and we wish you much success with the book.
Thank you so much.